My name is Sabine Kourio-McNeil. I studied mathematics and computing ages ago, and therefore I was always interested in the use of computers for communication, i.e. networking. And I was in one of the first internet cafes where I met a guy called Lord Sudley, or he had somehow heard that I was there every Wednesday. And he had organized a conference, or was short of co-organizing a conference. And I said, well, why not have little events at the House of Lords rather than a big conference? And that's how the Forum for Stable Currencies got started. And the reason why he was interested in monetary reform was because his great-great grandfather had been bankrupted by Lloyds Bank. And when we started the meetings, the people there who came were often victims of bank and institutions. And in fact, there were different groups of banking victims, the Lloyds victims, the Barclays victims, and so on. And so to know or to notice that this drama and trauma production has been going on over generations, and of anybody. I mean, one of my most classical victims was the owner of a Renault garage with 40 employees, where the bank just called some credit in, and he was bankrupted, and he later said it was just the pure jealousy of the bank manager. I mean, you can't make it up. So it's all so painful. It's all so terrible, Tony, when I think back, because it's been quite a long time ago now. But it was quite important because I was there as the event organizer, and I made the programs, and I was sort of the communicator. But there was a very, very good guy called Donald Martin, who was very au fait with the subject as well. He had run a mail order business of about all these sort of esoteric subjects,
Hang
and
on,
then there
I
was,
can remember him on Target magazine
that's true,
and Bloomfield Books.
yes, that's exactly right. Oh, how
Yeah,
fascinating.
because I mean, I think he at the time was accused of being involved with the far right.
Yeah, which also had applied to Lord Sudley. He was supposed to be a member of the Monday Club. And of course, I was just completely naive to politically. You know, I called myself a networker and an event organizer. I was a computer network, and happened to have come across this guy, Lord Sudley, and I found it, of course, more than interesting. And I used to be good at writing summaries of these various cases and publish them on one stage on the web. And at some stage, Lord Sudley said, you have to group cases in order to change the law. And that's and we tried to change the law by talking to Austin Mitchell as well. That he was the MP who was very hot on the subject, and so he through him I learned then how to table early day motions. Yeah, and thus I met victims of the system whom I would never have met unless it was because it was the venue. It was the House of Lords, and later the House of Parliament, the House of Commons, that where we just could use rooms for meetings. And this Renault owner, he once said so nicely that when he was asked by his parents, son, where are you going? You are suited and booted. Oh, well, I go to the House of Lords, you see. So that it made a difference, obviously, than if we had met in a pub, we might not have been as effective. And of course, I also had two guys who were videoing the meetings at the time. I don't know how much difference that made, but I still even have on YouTube now some of the recordings. And you will remember Maurice Kirk, who introduced himself on one of these meetings as well. because he had just come out of a psychiatric clinic where the system had put him into. And he was introduced to my circle by Norman Scarth, who was also a serious victim of the whole institutionalization, and who left me some money after he died, which was a nice surprise, you know.
So there was also
So,
another organisation called the Christian Council for Monetary Justice in London. I mean, we're talking now about the mid-late 1990s, roughly, but it does seem as if there was some sort of, leaning towards. Look, I mean, I don't want to accuse you of being far right at all, but it seems to me, and maybe you could help clarify this, that there was always an attempt to link serious campaigners around monetary reform with the far right, so as to sort of discredit it in a way. So I wonder if you yourself ever came across that, and also the Christian Council for Monetary Justice.
how fabulous that you remember all of that, Tony. Peter Challen was my man for the Christian Council of Monetary Justice, but there were quite a few others. And I had, in a way, I had taken over from them. And I can't, by moving or by using the House of Lords initially as the primary venue, and later after Lord Sudley was deselected from the House of Lords, we then moved to the House of Commons. But by using the Parliament as a meeting place, the members of the Christian Council of Justice for Justice came, and Donald Martin from his environment, which also included the Federation of Small Businesses, for example. So this far right angle, I had only vaguely noticed because of this Monday Club accusation, but I think especially from my current perspective, that this far right and left labeling is just part of the smearing that always happens and the dividing. And it's yes, because monetary reform touches the very nerve that needs to be touched. And I remember, for example, the Wikipedia page that I put together was corrupted. But no, we did not suffer directly, any of us.
Well, that's good to know. But look, can you just sum up what's wrong with the financial system and how people like the Forum for Stable Currencies, yourself, and CCMJ were trying to sort it out?
Well, I as a networker, I had learned about LETS, local exchange trading system, and professional barter systems, and therefore I knew what the difference about money and currency, and the Christian Council for Monetary Justice knew particularly well that and how. The problem is the national debt, and the national debt is created by private central banks. Nobody knows that the central banks are only national by name, but not by ownership. And that these central banks create money out of nothing and lend it to national governments at interest. That's how the national debt is created. And who benefits? Everybody who just gets the interest. And for 10 years, I studied the annual budget always of the government, and the interest payments were roughly as high as the military budget. That's wrong with the money system.
Well, that's a good point. But look, we know, many people know about the Federal Reserve being actually a private bank. But what about the Bank of England?
Well, that's the same problem. That's exactly the same problem, except that it started earlier. And in fact, that was, I mean, if I remember, it was at the end of the 17th or the 16th century. No,
Yeah, it
fifth.
was the end of the 16th century the Bank of England was set up. Sorry, the 17th century. After the Glorious Revolution. So we had the Civil War in the 1640s, and then we had the Restoration in the 1650s, and then we had the Glorious Revolution, where William of Orange came over the Protestant in a kind of, well, fairly bloodless coup. So the Stuart dynasty was booted out, and we had a bunch of Protestants take over Britain. And just after that was when they created the Bank of England.
Yeah, and in that, I remember the Act of Creation had the provision that the Bank of England should not be allowed to trade the way that it has been happening despite the Act. That is the problem with the English Bank of with the Bank of England. And Austin Mitchell regularly put in this early day motion about it, and I think the first one was number 1297, and which was the name of one of my blogs about it, because and he wrote every week to the then boss of the Bank of England. I can't remember his name, of course, but he, that act should be re that act with an E at the end should be respected or reinstated. But we never grew into a strong enough campaigning group.
It's at the heart of so much, this idea that whatever government you vote for, you still have a bank, a national bank, which has got private shareholders. But do we actually know who owns the Bank of England? Are we allowed to know?
I don't know, but I also remember having looked into the Deutsche Central Bank, and I was quite shocked that there was some there was certain information was just absolutely secret. One could not get hold of it with the Deutsche with the Bank of England.
Well, I think it's the same with the Bank of England, you know, Sabine. I mean, I remember going into the Bank of England Museum there and saying, "Well, who owns this bank?" And he just blankly looked at me and they said, "Well, that's confidential." And so you think, yeah, so somebody else owns it. And whoever you vote for, they don't really seem to have, you know, it's very similar to this, you know, the Bank for International Settlements in Switzerland, where it's actually a completely separate country. The bank has got its own police force and everything. You've got the same with the City of London, haven't you? You know, this is a
That's
separate.
exactly that's true for the City of London and in Washington as well.
It's right on the spine of history, this whole business of monetary reform. Now we're
But you
facing.
need to know, and you may also remember that in Canada, the equivalent was the social credit movement, and that's what it is really about in terms of solution, that that people should be the carriers of value and credit and not hot air.
Hang on, because social credit is a movement which was a reform, monetary reform movement in Britain, and I don't know, in Canada too. But nowadays, this has come to mean the social credit system in China. If you talk about social credit, which is the idea that everybody has got some sort of profile and they're scored on how obedient they are.
Oh God! No, that's no. The social credit. I mean, we were just in touch in terms of like-mindedness, or what we all knew also about. There was one particular guy who was, I don't think he's alive anymore. He was a politician as well, who was after in Canada. So and then of course there was the web of debt. The Ellen. The California woman from California, her daughter studied at the London School of Economics and wanted to write her PhD about this. And the professor said, "Well, that's not part of our curriculum.
Oh, you're
That's
talking about
not.
Ellen Brown.
That's right."
No, this is not part of our story today, even though you're here. Look, I mean, just tell us what you make of, because it looks like the world is facing a potential economic crash at the moment because of the Straits of Hormuz being, the oil supplies being all cut off, lots of other commodities too. The oil pipelines are working overtime tonight. And because we've got this illegal attack on Iran going on, the United Nations, and bizarrely and perversely, have just been issued a sort of fatwa against Iran. Well, they've said that they're condemning Iran for retaliating for actually making any reaction to reacting to the illegal strikes on them. But what do you make of the global situation these days and finance generally?
Well, you will be amused to hear that today I was shocked to notice that two banks here in my little town of 25,000 people were closed without a sign. So on the door, and I hadn't noticed anything by email. And so that to me may be a sign that there's a collapse. But I mean, I deal with the problem when it comes up on one level. On another level, it depends very much who your sources of information are. I mean, it's all about a financial reset that is meant to be happening in one way or another, and who wins, the good guys or the bad guys, is I think up to nobody to predict.
So how do you think it's likely to play out? What do you think is going to happen?
Oh, I am convinced that the bad guys will lose and the good guys will win. I mean, there is no doubt about it in my mind. This is just the biggest transformation towards goodness that has to happen. I mean, I've been aware of these 2,000-year cycles for a long time, and talks of the new age. And if you look into YouTube and I mean, wherever you want to look, we are just in very heavy transformational times, and people couldn't anticipate it that it would be as people couldn't anticipate that it is as bad as it is in terms of child abuse and satanic ritual abuse and blackmailing of the elite and in the West. But as people are waking up to that as the main mechanism that holds the ruling elite together, things have to change for better because they can't hide anymore. They can't go away. I just read about this. There was in Holland was a law case, a court case against Bill Gates, and I mean it's so. Things are just happening on in all sorts
Well,
of
look,
levels.
you say that, but of course, the international elite, banksters, the Bilderbergers, these people have been preparing for this moment for a while, haven't they? You know, if there is a collapse, they've very definitely got their system that they want to roll out.
Well, maybe yes, maybe no. Maybe there are people who won't accept it. I cannot, and I won't imagine that they are not safe, these people anymore. And whatever system they want to roll out, they will not be able to sell onto anybody anymore. Or not everybody. Not everybody will go along anymore.
Yeah, I
I mean,
don't
it's
think
a,
this.
children are now demoing and refusing here in Germany to go to war. The people are waking up at different levels, and so it's I hate to make any kind of large generalization. I
Okay, fair
just
enough.
am
Well, I'm always
confident that.
asking to people to try and peer into the crystal ball, particularly because people like you, Sabine, have been very observing very carefully the way that currencies work, that financial arrangements work, that the public are bamboozled by these various systems. But what do you make of the war and the Epstein case? Because there's quite a lot of people saying, well, looks as if this war is being launched in order to cover up a lot of these Epstein crimes.
Well, yeah, because the Epstein, that is in a way that is the boil that is now that has broken, and the fact that Epstein was as politically active and maneuvering as it begins to turn out, that of course I guess nobody knew. I mean, for me, it is definitely the. Well, the big relief. I mean, even the name of the Hampstead girl appears twice in the Epstein file.
Okay, could you say something about that and your involvement in that case?
Well, the Hampstead case came to me because I had published a website called the Association of Mackenzie Friends, and the mother whose two children had been taken in by police contacted me, and of course I was unsuccessful as even a barrister who had once told me that in 12 years she had never gotten a child back. But you see, as t child taking parents losing their children to the system of social services covered by police, covered by secret family courts is one thing. When you hear two children, 8 and 9 years old, describing the piercings and tattoos of the genitals of their abusers, then you better listen. But no, the system made sure that they retracted, were forced into retracting what they had said and observed. The doctor who had written the medical reports was forced to, I can't remember exactly how she was punished, but anyway, the cover-up was bigger than the crimes. And of course, the mainstream media played along big time. Unfortunately, as soon as I ended up spending 4 years in prison and was deported by it, accompanied by a team of five people who looked after me just in case, because I was potentially violent, I guess. And pretty shortly afterwards, I was contacted first by Nu Tortoise Media and then by Story Films TV. Were apparently commissioned by Channel 4 to make a film about what they called the Hampstead hoax. But of course, they didn't convey that to me, did they? Just as the BBC, when they interviewed me when I was in Berlin before, when I was in exile for 6 months, naively not knowing how bad the system is, how badly they need to cover up what they're covering up,
Well, look,
Tony.
now is your chance. If you can, in a nutshell, just sum up what you really found. If you'd had the opportunity to do that on Channel 4, what would you be saying?
That it is absolutely shameful that they sell their souls to lies and lies and lies and present it as truth. I mean, crimes are bad enough. There is an EU directive which says that clearly children should be listened to before adults, because it's a hell of a lot more likely that adults have a vested interest in covering up their crimes than that children make things up about details. But no, the cover-ups got worse and worse and worse, from police to local family court to high court, and then to Tortoise Media, and then to Channel 4.
So
I mean, you can't.
the press is supposed to be a sort of last court of appeal, but it seems in this case it's the opposite. The idea is it's the end of the cover up. But so what, for anyone that's familiar with the Hampstead ha case, what in a nutshell, can you just sum up what you would say in your defence?
The children. And I mean, why did I have 16,000 signatures on the petition which I addressed to the then Home Secretary, Theresa May, release the children from, I called them the whistleblower kids, and said free them or release them to their Russian family. And so 16,000 people believed the children. But the police doesn't, and the other supporters, not me, were punished and imprisoned and put into a mental hospital. I mean, the cover-ups are worse than the crimes committed. So the system is absolutely hell-bent to cover up and not to let these crimes come out. But these children are completely precious because they, independently of each other, as well as together, they sang this from the same hymn sheet, so they were 100% believable. And there was another petition out which was closed after 2,000 signatures, just because the publisher didn't really look after them. But all they wanted to do is to just get the genitals investigated, which the children described. The children had made drawings. Everything was crystal clear. But no, it had to be covered up. And what is the vested interest? Why does Channel 4 need to play that game?
Well, it doesn't really. I think it just chooses to do so. Anyway, look, also Sabine, we've got to talk a bit about the whereabouts we're heading with this war. What do you make of how it fits in and how long it's going to last?
Oh, I can't do that. I'm too much of a of it just brings me to tears, Tony. I'm too much. My family was a victim of the war. I survived Dresden. I was 5 months old when my mom rescued me through the bombing of Dresden. I can't cope with war. All I know is that wars are part of the machinery that the elite uses to rule and divide and conquer, and there's just never any rhyme or reason except vested interests, vested interests, vested interests, and I mean every sane person would start by not by stopping the production of weapons, and those kind of campaigns have been going on also for decades. So I just really, really, really seriously hope that again more and more people are waking up and refusing to play along. That's all I can say.
Well, yes, and of course, in the Middle East, many people are going to sleep and never waking up again. What about the internet as well? Because we were sold this thing in the 1990s. I certainly believed, to a certain extent, that the internet was going to be a complete like democratization of communication, and that it was going to be. And of course, it has in many ways. It's revolutionized communications. But we've got these things called algorithms. We've got these tech giants. How do you think it's all going?
Well, now you are on to my absolutely favorite subject. Thank you, because as I said, I'm a mathematician, but I'm technically trained. I know how computers operate, and I revisited mathematics through the eyes of a computer programmer now for 30 years, and I'm putting it now into a system that I call Eureka dot digital, because it's going to be a platform on which one can re-look not only at numbers and mathematics and physical data and biological data and chemical data and anything, because it's all what is called generic, but I've also got a kind of modeling that is perfectly ideal. So I shall use not just the internet, but even AI for the benefit of mankind. And that's why what I went to into prison for. I found the pattern of prime numbers in prison because I was forced to think on pen and paper, which means slowly rather than as one it's chased on computers. So I have now, if you like, more of, or I will have soon. I'm going to present my work on April 30th. That's my deadline. I'm going to have the chance of my lifetime, and I really, really feel this is sort of what my mom rescued me for. This is it's my life's work, and it's a crystallization of thinking and analyzing, and yes, there are. I mean, the internet, like any computer, is like any knife. It's a tool that can be used for good and for bad, for evil. And it's up to the every individual to make that choice day by day, moment by moment.
I mean, I can remember the advent of things like in the 90s of things like news groups, and there was all sorts of stuff out there on the internet which seemed very promising, most of which now has been either shut down or sort of taken over, privatized by the Googles of this world.
Well, yes, globalization has been going on big time, hasn't it? But there are also these alternatives. I mean, there is a little group that my nephew pointed it out to me here, or that puts neighbors in touch with each other, but countrywide. So yes, globalization has been happening, whether it's bookstores or small shops corner shops anywhere, but also meetings, conferences. Yes, it's the Googles, the big techs, but I shall challenge them, watch this space, because it's very interesting. This whole movement of computers taking over, if you like, has been challenged. And I've got a kind of a tradition of thinkers before me. There was a guy called Josef Weizenbaum, whose book was called Computer Power and Human Reason. And he said that whatever is built can only be built by the mathematics that are known at that given time. And there's a woman, an Australian journalist and scientist called Margaret Wertheim. She published a book called Pythagoras Trousers with the subtitle Physics and the Gender Wars. And she pointed out that and how physics has dominated mathematics. And here I come along with mathematics, wanting to, if you like, dominate again and needing to dominate again to iron out false assumptions in th that have and to sort out problems that have been unsolved so far. But I want to do it such that people can discover it for themselves via interactive software, rather than that I stand up and preach or not even publish as such. So that's where I'm standing in
Well, it
this.
sounds to me, I mean, the most powerful thing you can do, I think, online in a way is platforms, providing platforms for people.
That's exactly right.
As the big commercial platforms, the networks, the X, the Facebooks, all these people, these
Yes.
tech titans or whatever they are,
Yeah.
Olympians, they think they. I mean, in a way, what we've got is we've got this glimpse into what it's like to be on Mount Olympus. These individuals that think that they have these godlike qualities, they know everything, they can control what people see, what they don't see, and that's, to me, is the sort of betrayal of the internet really there.
Absolutely. As in total abuse and it's very sad, yeah.
But it's a tug of war, and of course people will react against that and seek out. Anyway, can you just remind us of this platform that you're launching in April?
It's
Whereabouts
called
is it?
Eureka.digital, and it's Eureka with H, which is the ancient Greek. It actually exists. It stands already as a website, but not yet. As there, I'm just describing it as if it was a book. But I now, and you wouldn't believe it, Tony, but I have actually made programmers superfluous by working with AI. So I have now installed the kind of engine that I first had asked developers to build for me. And that's what I mean, if that is not good use of AI, I mean, it's not that I made them superfluous, because what I've also appreciated at that time, and it's that and how software development has changed from kind of straightforward translating mathematical and physical equations and formula into computer language into such an entanglement of interlocking systems. It's unbelievable that anything can work at all, because there are far too many sources for errors. I mean, it's just I really find that, I was 22 when I came to CERN in Geneva at the European Centre for Nuclear Research as a diagnostician for software. I solved the computer problems for Nobel Prize winners until I got bored with that. But I went there thinking that that's where they understand the smallest and the largest. Well, they don't. Now, astrophysicists don't know how to talk to nuclear physicists. And I have now found the key to the misunderstandings, let's say. And that is exactly what this video was about that you sent me, about when one woman asked a CERN physicist, how many dimensions are you dealing with? And he said 17. Well, that's the number of dimensions that string theory presupposes. And I have discovered that mathematics treats dimension differently than physics. And I'm using dimensionality as the key to developing a whole system based on dimensional intelligence. And Copilot is my co-thinker.
Wow. Anyway, look, Sabine McNeil, thanks ever so much for joining us again. And I suppose people can join you if they want to at eureka.digital. You
Yes, thank you.
better just spell it for us again.
H E U R E K A dot digital. I mean, that was Eureka was the cry. I've got it. Yeah, I've got it. It was the, it's the insight that you get, or as my developer said, from wow to aha, from the nice surprise to understanding, from insight to understanding, because it's on screen and I can make something visible on screen that one couldn't on paper. Science was invented on paper. Now it's we're talking about screen-based science, and that's a different matter.
So thanks very much for joining us, Sabine. Take care.
Thank you for giving me such an opportunity, Tony.